The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I still think it would behoove Congress, if they could find a way to make this not partisan, to have some hearings on Pfizer reform, right? And to actually revisit some of the proposals. You know, we're not going to agree on what the right answers are, but at least let's have it out.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 1st, 2020. I'll get to the main introduction in a second, but before I do, I want to alert listeners to a new podcast from Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. It's The Impeachment. Every day, Lawfare and Goat Rodeo bring you a distilled version of the previous day's Senate impeachment trial proceedings. We turn the long days of trial proceedings into a distilled hour and a half version that you can listen to in the car on your way to work, while you're walking your dog, wherever. You can get it on the same podcast feed as The Report, wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is the second edition of a Lawfare-edited National Security Law podcast. The National Security Law podcast is hosted by Lawfare founder Bobby Chesney and Lawfare contributing editor Steve Vladek, both of whom are professors at the University of Texas Law School. They offer a weekly deep dive on national security law topics that's available wherever you get your podcasts. This week, they had a particularly useful discussion on the legal issues surrounding John Bolton's role in the impeachment trial and on important developments in the military commissions that have been overshadowed by events in Washington. So, we decided to bring an edited version of their conversation to you on the Lawfare podcast. We've distilled it down so you get all the substantive exchanges from Bobby and Steve on these important topics. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 503. The National Security Law Podcast guys talk Bolton.
A quick disclosure to listeners. This conversation took place before many of the conversations in the Senate about Bolton, about witnesses, and it took place before Friday's vote to block witnesses from appearing in the impeachment trial.
Hello from Austin. Welcome to episode 152 of the National Security Law Podcast. We are brought to you by the Robert Strauss Center at the University of Texas. It's Wednesday. It's January 29th. It's 2020. It's Bobby Chesney.
It's Steve Vladek.
Here we are.
Hello.
Nice to see you. All right. So today, friends, on the show, here's what we've got. You may not know this, but we've got some breaking news. There's an impeachment underway, and people are interested in whether John Bolton's going to testify. We're going to look ahead to the possibility that the probability that there will be a subpoena for Bolton. And then we'll talk about what it would look like legally and procedurally should the executive branch try to stop him nonetheless. We'll pivot from that and other impeachment-related talk to a fascinating move by the Justice Department in the FISA court relating back to the Inspector General's report on the investigation in FISA applications relating to Carter Page. DOJ told the court at least two of those applications should not have been submitted. Well, you know, in some ways it's like, well, duh, read the report. On the other hand, like, whoa, that Justice Department does not normally go in and concede that ground. And it's very interesting because, well, we'll talk about why it's interesting, because it has implications for something that may happen or may not happen 6 weeks from now.
Indeed.
Beware the Ides of March, my friends. We'll turn our attention to Gitmo, and we'll note the unfolding, fascinating testimony by Mitchell and Justin. Is it both of them, by the way? Are they both testifying? Relating to their creation of the EIT program, the prisoner abuse, the torture program, relating to people who are waterboarded, et cetera, which is all unfolding in the context of the KSM and co-defendants 9/11 trial. And then while we're on the subject of military courts, we will explore an interesting question. Could Gallagher be brought?
Well, you should explain the provocation, right? That Eddie Gallagher, the war criminal SEAL who President Trump pardoned, put a video on Facebook yesterday talking about naming and identifying the units of all the soldiers who he thinks wronged him.
Gave addresses, I believe, didn't he?
Yep. So lots of PII, personally identifiable information.
Interesting. So lots of interesting questions sort of from a legal perspective whether it is this guy, and you've got a dog in this fight, I do believe, and it's interesting because it's complex for you, I'd imagine. Is he someone who could be subjected to court-martial, and if so, what kind of charge would actually be relevant there?
Just to spoil a little bit of the conversation, right? Everyone's like, he retired. No, he's in the Fleet Reserve. And under Article 2A6 of the UCMJ, he's subject to court-martial.
So when you and I were tweeting about this, and I just posed the question, hey, military justice experts such as you, is this guy, you know, could there be a UCMJ?
I thought, hey, military justice experts and Steve.
And Steve. That was the inclusive and, not the exclusive one. And speaking of, and so all of these people start weighing in, many of whom seem to know something about what they're talking about. And then, of course, being Twitter, it's like, oh, that's me. I've got it. Hey, dumbass. He's out of the military.
Yeah, he retired. What are you talking about?
All right. Thanks, y'all. Thanks for playing.
Twitter law.
So, all right.
Let's diving in. John Bolton. He's back.
Okay.
Where is he?
So I listened, you know,
We're going to read his book in a skiff. That's how that'll show him.
This is like the all-time greatest marketing. I don't remember which publisher has the book, but they have
it's all a conspiracy. It's the same publisher that had Comey's book. And don't you know, it's the deep state. The deep state has moved to the publishing houses on Madison Avenue.
So the strings on the walls of the fever-minded conspiracy theorists can put the publisher at the middle of
the apex.
Yes. So there was a really funny comment when Lawfare Podcast has been doing some human service by condensing everything through the Report podcast feed, which is definitely worth doing. But they've also just had some discussion podcast. And I listened yesterday to a great one where Ben Wittes observed at some point that there's this waiting for Godot kind of quality. It's like this brooding omnipresence, this mustachioed omnipresence looming ever off the stage, but everything on stage is taking place in the shadow of it. So perfect. But I also couldn't help thinking, like, is it waiting for Godot or is it waiting for Guffman? Because there's a little bit of a Guffman kind of quality to this too, don't you think?
Yep.
And of course, the grave concern is, like, is this just like another Mueller report type of thing where people pin all sorts of ideas and hopes and dreams and expectations and fears on all sides of the issue on something that in the end is going to land pretty flat? Do you think that's likely to be the case? Or do you think that if he gets in there and testifies, he's going to, you know, both barrels blazing?
I think the Republicans are deeply afraid that Bolton's going to mess up their narrative. You know, and I think we've seen that from trying to, you know, not just immediately saying we're going to let him testify, not just, you know, the efforts to discredit him, right? Oh, he's a liar.
The president's going after him pretty hard. Surprise, surprise. Because if you ever do something for this president and then later on do anything he doesn't like, he is going to trash you.
That's right. So, you know, my sense is that there's a real concern, not that Bolton's going to, like, sway, you know, what is it, 20 Republican senators into voting to convict the president. That's not going to happen. Yeah. But that he's going to make it look really, really bad that they're not doing that, right? That putting Bolton on the stand, having video clips of him testifying under oath and penalty of perjury, that basically vindicates all the worst parts of this story, you know, is just going to embarrass the F out of the Republicans.
And rightly so, if and when that happens, because if it goes the way it seems like it's going to go, or it might go, what it will do is it will strip away all the denial arguments and leave only the ultimate argument that a few of them, like the chief of staff one time, advanced that like, okay, all right, fine. You got me. That's exactly what happened.
And this is,
but it's not impeachable anyways.
That's where we're heading. And this is like, I mean, Maggie Haberman there was a piece yesterday, I don't know if it was Maggie's or somebody else's, but I saw it from Maggie's tweet about how Republican senators were blindsided by the revelations in the Bolton book. And it's like, no, you weren't blindsided by it. You have chosen to obfuscate and to, you know, shoo away from trying to get to the bottom of any of this. You're blindsided that, like, the White House didn't prevent this from coming out.
Right. The surprise is... And by the way, even the surprise was foreshadowed. Right. Bolton said he testified, if subpoenaed.
That's right.
People knew he was working on a book.
That's right.
Is it any surprise?
No, they weren't blind. No, I want to be clear. Yeah. They weren't blindsided by the book. They were blindsided by the White House's inability to prevent the book from coming out at the worst possible time.
And even that is stupid, because, like, how would they? So let's now talk about what we have any vague competence to talk about. There's a rare move for us. We'll talk about our stuff. So... assume they get the votes, and there will be witnesses, and if there are witnesses, Bolton will be one. So it gets the subpoena issues, and the White House desperately, and others desperately want him to somehow nonetheless be precluded from testifying. What's the most likely, whether it works or not, what's the most likely pathway? Can they just go to the district court and seek an injunction?
Nope.
So is map the possibilities and then tell us what's likely.
This is actually my final exam question on my con law exam.
With Bolton?
Not Bolton, but like that? It was you know, something goes to Twitter in the impeachment trial and the president wants to go to court.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I think it was the Senate agrees to vote by secret ballot. Okay. All right. Long and short version, right? Let's start with what the Senate impeachment rules say. And I actually pulled up the Senate impeachment rules.
I have Kurt Vonnegut right here.
So, indeed, Kurt. So, Rule VII, Rule 7 of the Senate's Standing Rules on Impeachment provide that the presiding officer of the Senate, so Chief Justice John Roberts, happy birthday, Chief, shall direct all necessary preparation, blah, blah, blah. The presiding officer may rule on all questions of evidence, including, but not limited to, questions of relevancy, materiality, and redundancy of evidence, and incidental questions, which ruling shall stand as the judgment of the Senate unless some member of the Senate shall ask that a formal vote be taken thereon, in which case it shall be submitted to the Senate for decision without debate. Or he, back to the chief again, may at his option in the first instance submit any such question to a vote of the members of the Senate. So this is really, I want to get to the core part of it, but just starting with, like, suppose that in the Senate trial, right, we call John, you know, House managers, we call John Bolton as a witness, and, you know, Jay Sekulow, I object, right, his testimony is protected by privilege, right? In the first instance, Rule 7 says that question goes to the Chief Justice. And Rule 7 gives the Chief Justice the power to either decide it himself or punt it to the Senate.
But wait, if I heard you right, there's an option on objection from a member of the Senate. It then has to be put without...
Decide it himself.
Right.
Right. Which can be overruled, right, upon objection and then majority vote.
Right.
Right, not decided at all and kick it to the Senate in the first instance, at which point he's out of it.
So assuming that he's otherwise going to testify in the... And the obstacle is that the administration's arguing executive privilege for the parts that hurt. And
well, that's another problem, right? Is that executive privilege doesn't prevent him from testifying.
So just bracket that for a second. Yeah. Just procedurally to map, like, who's going to decide the different key stages.
Yeah.
This example assumes the subpoena's been issued. He shows up. Or wouldn't he be deposed first?
It's not clear.
The subpoena could be ad testificandum.
It could be.
And also, deuces tecum. Yep. That is, bring documents with you, which is important here.
So the chief part's what's interesting, because the chief has the choice, right, of either ruling first, but subject to being overruled by the Senate,
or
passing the buck. And I have to say.
Yeah, he'll rule.
Because here's the thing. If I'm moderate Republican senator who has principles, which may be a zero set.
I don't think so, but go ahead.
I know you don't. That's why I said, I don't know. Right? Am I more likely to, you know, support a broad privilege claim before the Chief Justice has rejected it or after?
Oh, it's going to be much harder after Chief Justice John Roberts has basically written an opinion explaining what's wrong with that sort of argument.
Now, the chief, of course, is probably a pretty broad proponent of executive privilege, but not probably on the terms that the Trumpies are claiming.
Let's have that as our goal, is to get to the doctrine and apply it to what's probably happening here.
The executive privilege to cover stuff that's been talked about over and over.
I don't want to talk about that yet. Yes. Let's get to that.
Okay.
First, just imagine what will happen here. So imagine it's going to be a subpoena first to be deposed with documents.
Yep.
What's the procedural posture to stop that? Is it A, that the White House tries to intervene or McConnell, someone goes to court to try to prevent him outright from showing up? Because is it the deposition wouldn't be in front of Roberts, would it? Wouldn't be in the?
I don't know. I don't know if the rule. So I should know, and I don't know if the rule speaks specifically to how that would work. So there are two, right? Presumably, assuming this comes out of the Senate. So assuming that there is some kind of where the Senate itself. So imagine four or more Republican senators have joined with the Democrats to vote to issue this thing.
Which seems, by the way, apparently very likely to happen.
The headlines keep going back and forth on this, right? So imagine that happens. Then the Senate, right, he puts in scare quotes, has formally acted to subpoena Bolton. So I don't think McConnell can do anything.
Yeah, right. Right. So the White House moves to intervene and tries to assert their privilege.
So I see two possibilities. One is this all gets fought over in the forum of the Senate, right, under the auspices of Rule 7, where everything would be basically up to the chief to either decide or punt.
Right.
Right. Or Trump, as he's threatening to do, goes to court. Here's the problem with going to court. The problem with going to court is the Supreme Court's decision in Walter Nixon versus the United States.
Judge Nixon.
Judge Nixon. The other Nixon.
The other Nixon.
The Nixon who actually was impeached.
Right. Exactly.
So Walter Nixon was a corrupt federal district judge who was convicted of various financial crimes and perjury, I think, but refused to resign his commission. House impeaches him, Senate removes him, but they do so by committee. They couldn't even be bothered to spend time having the whole Senate try him. This is in the early 90s. Walter Nixon then brings a lawsuit saying that his trial violated his, various rights, including his right to due process and various other procedural protections, because he was entitled to be tried by the entire Senate and not just by a committee thereof. And the Supreme Court in the Walter Nixon decision in 1993 says, well, the majority opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist says this is a non-justiciable political question, meaning we're not ruling up or down on whether what the Senate did was appropriate because we have no, that's not our job.
We don't get to police the process the Senate chooses to use.
This kind of thing just ain't my bag, right? And so the majority opinion says as a categorical matter that procedural disputes arising out of how the Senate conducts an impeachment trial are not justiciable. And indeed, if you actually go back and read the chief's majority opinion, the whole reason why he's like obstinate about this is because he thinks in a presidential impeachment, it cannot be the job of the courts, right, to be second-guessing the political process.
So what happens when they have the subpoena go out?
Yeah.
It's a deposition.
Yep.
And the way, for those who haven't litigated or been deposed, I suppose, the way this unfolds in a normal setting is, so everybody's at the conference room, lawyers on both sides of the table, the witnesses begins answering questions in response to whoever's taking the yep. deposition. You get to attorney-client privilege or some question supposedly is infringing. Normally, there's a fight at that point.
Yep, and if it's the judge.
If it's a privilege question, you either reserve it and come back at another day after you yep. litigate it, maybe through filings, or if you must, you get on the phone and you try to get the judge involved remotely, mm-hmm. often by the phone, maybe people go down to the courthouse. Are they going to then be going to Chief Justice Roberts, who on what you've just yeah. described about Nixon suggests is he's the only judge who gets to weigh in on this. There is no further pathway. There's no appeal from it except to the Senate itself.
Well, he weighs in not as a judge. He weighs as in as the presiding officer of the Senate.
Right. But he'll do it in a judgy kind of way.
Well, of course he will.
He's the chief. So any attempt to like go get an injunction to stop this whole thing, are you suggesting if there's a separate standalone filing to enjoin any testimony,
it'll be promptly dismissed on the.
It should be dismissed under Nixon.
Yes. Now, I want to be clear. There is a non-preposterous argument, right, that there are at least a couple of claims that Nixon does not preclude, right? So,
yeah.
So Nixon itself, the majority opinion by Rehnquist, talks about how if the Senate were actually to violate one of the three procedural rules in the Constitution for impeachment trials,
mm-hmm.
so if, for example, they removed without a 2/3 vote of those present, if they did right. not go on oath or affirmation, or if the chief didn't preside.
Right. So to prevent constitutional crisis, there might be a few exceptions.
But I don't see the argument, but like the whole point of Rehnquist's opinion was that's it. Like
right.
we can review maybe those three things and nothing else.
Now, dear listeners, notice we haven't actually addressed the merits
nope.
of the executive privilege claim. That we, by the way, is there anything other than executive privilege that would be the basis for trying to stop him from testifying?
I mean, theoretically, right? You could claim it's classified, but
right. No, they've thrown that around. That's in all caps in a Trump tweet
this
morning.
But it's also a lie.
Right,
it's a classified lie. It's false and it's classified.
It is certainly possible. It is certainly the case that as National Security Advisor, John Bolton became privy to all sorts of classified information.
Sure.
It's very possible that lots of conversations were conversations about classified information. There could even be these, I can imagine the realm of possibility, some intersections where in talking about Ukraine stuff, in the course of the conversation, the slivers or strands of classified information about, you know, perhaps surveillance capabilities or sources could come out in a conversation that has the National Security Advisor. But the conversations that we care about, that apparently are written about in this book that probably will be published, seem to be conversations about policy and process and politics and who's doing what, and it ain't about classified information.
Well, but also, the book went through a pre-publication review process.
Is that clear? It's already been clear?
I thought that's what the letter said. I thought that Bolton's lawyer sent a letter that said, guys, we sent you this book for pre-publication review. A process, we should say to our listeners, is designed to ensure that no published book includes...
Okay, so if that's the case, that may be the greatest, most hilarious, and perfectly fitting example of the inability... There's this malevolence...
I want to look up the letter, because I want to make sure I'm getting this right.
So if it's right, you've got this malevolence, or at least mendacious operation in the White House that is also just so ineffective in using the levers of power they've got.
It's Chuck Cooper, who, you know, is hilarious. Yeah. All right.
I guess what I'm getting at while you're looking that up is they readily could have at least slow rolled that. That happens a lot. Yeah. It shouldn't, but
so
it does.
I guess they could have
slow rolled it. They could have actually tried to say, like, hey, these conversations are all classified. And if they're sort of bungling enabled this, that could have been a safety valve.
So I think the pre-publication review, it may not be complete, but the letter is like this preemptive letter, like, hey, don't mess with us.
Well, that's very different.
No, I know. So the letter is something like, as I mentioned, Master Bill has carefully sought to avoid any discussion in the manuscript of sensitive compartmented information or other classified information. We do not believe the pre-publication review is required. Ah, so they didn't think it was required.
Oh, I bet it's in his contract.
But we are nonetheless submitting this manuscript out of an abundance of caution as contemplated by the non-disclosure agreements that he entered, commencing with those of April 5, 2018. I appreciate your assurance that the sole purpose of pre-publication security review is to ensure that SCI or other classified information is not publicly disclosed. In keeping with that purpose, it's our understanding that the process of reviewing submitted materials is restricted to those career government officials and employees regularly charged with responsibility for such reviews.
No, you can see their concerns, but actually this tells me that the administration, the White House, still may play dirty pool here and may, in some way or fashion, lo and behold, reveal that the book's been determined to have this whole section, maybe about 11 pages, that covers classified information and can't be revealed.
So I guess
what I'm saying is they won't be as stopped by their own pre-pub process, which clearly hasn't finished yet.
I guess that's right. So I misunderstood the headline. But wait, so the White House has now apparently, this is breaking news as we're sitting here.
The White House has issued
a formal threat to former National Security Advisor John Bolton to keep him from publishing his memoir.
Yeah, that's so. This is all just posturing.
Of course it is. So
we're back to the merits.
Yes.
Lindsey Graham says
we could read the book in a skiff.
In ordinary litigation, the way this ought to work is the witness is in there, and the executive branch should be able to intervene in a regular litigation that's not precluded by justiciability concerns, should be able to protect executive privilege if properly invoked, and there could be. There's some possible basis for this.
Well, executive privilege is a shield. It's not a sword. Like, I'm not familiar with any lawsuit where the executive branch has successfully enjoined someone's voluntary compliance with a subpoena or other testimony on the ground.
I can't say that there's an example of it, but isn't the logic of it that it's a privilege that belongs to the president?
Sure, but
so if John Bolton wants to spill the beans on these conversations, if the privilege is otherwise enforceable, Bolton doesn't get to waive it.
But I'm not sure. No, but hold on a second. But the privilege protects against compelled disclosure. And even if it's the subpoena that requires him to show up, if he's willing to answer a question voluntarily at that point, right?
Why is it different from attorney-client privilege, right? So if my attorney, if I tell my attorney certain inculpatory things to in the course of protected advice, and then the attorney... This gets complicated because my example I started to go through would have led towards crime fraud exceptions.
Right,
let's just talk about, and by the way, is there a crime fraud exception to executive privilege?
I mean, all of this.
Why not?
Yes.
But if it's something just embarrassing or whatever, and my attorney decides, like, well, I want to voluntarily share that with the public because it's salacious, I should be able to preclude him from doing that if the privilege attaches.
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know if that's true or if it's just that, like, he's going to lose his job the second he does it and he's going to be disbarred and you're going to have lots of causes of action against him.
Yeah, well, okay, it's an interesting question. I would think you'd be able to make that privilege
stick. I will just say that I'm unfamiliar with any prior case, right, where privilege was used as a sword, not a shield. But I think most of this is moot, right? And I think most of it is moot because all of this shit is in the public domain already. Like, forget the book. right? I mean, like, you know, the president talks about this publicly. Bolton has talked about this publicly.
So wait, hold
other
on.
People have talked about
this
publicly.
We got to define this and be precise. So what really matters here, the kernel, the one sentence in the manuscript that will matter is the one that maybe will say...
Is anything going to matter?
Yeah, that's a larger question. But on the assumption that this is entirely a waste, there will be a sentence in there or a paragraph that describes and puts words in the mouth of the president saying he said something, something, quid pro quo, absolutely, something like that, yada, yada, yada. Bolton hasn't himself said that publicly. The whole point is that we think that maybe we've been told it might be in this manuscript, and now we're trying to convert this into a public statement that can be part of the impeachment trial. So I don't actually know that the particular kernel that's the thing that matters. A lot of the rest of it public, yes, but the thing that matters, I don't think is public. And that's why this is also such a big deal, because we have reason to believe that John Bolton is admitting that, yep, if you give me the right way, I will say the magic words you're looking for.
Which led to, I thought, the greatest tweet of all time by our friend Matt Tate. Did you see this tweet?
No, what did he say?
Wouldn't it be ironic if the only regime John Bolton actually succeeds in bringing down is his own?
Oh, my God. That is so funny. That's awesome.
If the shoe fits. So I think the problem is that
I will say. Can I just digress? Also, I never liked Trump's tweet, but I gotta admit, I did chuckle because he has this whole thing where he's trashing John Bolton. He has a line that's something like, you know, and if I'd listened to him, we'd be in World War VI by now. That's pretty funny.
And you know, I
may be right.
I don't disagree.
No, that's why it's funny.
Right. I mean, even a stop clock is right twice a day. Yeah. So, I think there are, at the bottom of this, some interesting privilege questions. But I think most of this is a smokescreen.
Well, here's why I think this matters, though. Because, okay, so it's not going to be separately litigated. But if Roberts is the key to providing the top cover for, if his opinion rejecting privilege claims is that, as the presiding officer, is going to be the central thing. But if actually there's a real... If it turns out there's a real privilege question here, it's not obvious he'll do what I think would otherwise be the right thing. All that said, based on the leaking about what the conversation was like, it's really hard to see that there could be a credible presentation to Roberts that any kind of classified information was in there. Instead, it's going to be deliberative privilege, which is totally different. Deliberative privilege can be overcome.
Yep.
Doesn't present the same degree of constitutional exigency.
Yep.
And so that's why I think in the end, Roberts will rule that this is admissible.
Or,
and then you'd have to have a vote to overrule him, which would be real hard.
Or there will be a deal, right? Or, you know, the four senators who the Democrats will need, right, to make any of this happen are going to make a deal where they say in exchange for agreeing to subpoena Bolton, we're going to sit down and hammer out exactly what the sort of scope of his testimony is going to be to avoid 36 rounds of privilege fights. Because one of the things that the White House has been doing has been saying to the senators, you should not vote to allow Bolton to testify because otherwise we're going to have to go down this rabbit hole. Right, like, and
they don't. Well, they just don't want to extend it, right?
Well, but
is that
also,
what you're saying?
So I think there are two different problems. I think there are some senators who just don't want any egg on their face for any reason, and there are ones who just want this to be over no matter what, right? And you know, the Bolton testimony is going to complicate it, especially if it doesn't come with a deal in advance about, you know, the agreed upon scope of what he's going
What's
to say.
What's the motivation for Romney and Collins, et cetera, to do any kind of deal other than just casting their vote to call Bolton and see what happens? I thought you were going to go down the Hunter Biden path, because I feel like that's where...
Oh, God.
That's where
that's
the
leverage is, right?
That's
a whole different kettle of fish.
It is, and it does seem like the kind of fallback position for McConnell is going to be to try to poison the chalice by saying, oh, okay, well, if I don't have the votes to... And I think, by the way, this is why all the headlines keep shifting. I think it's a real serious problem, because they're trying to create a false equivalency in the relevance of what John Bolton has to say, which is... You know, as literally as relevant as anything you could make up. And then the Hunter Biden thing, which has this sort of narrative connection, obviously, but doesn't, you know, what he might say or might not say in no way can, since presumably Donald Trump isn't privy to anything Hunter Biden's about to testify, if he were made to testify, can't affect whether there's been obstruction of Congress, can't affect whether there was an attempt to exact this quid pro quo. All it would do is narratively, and this would be a big deal, narratively make the president seem sort of justified in it all in a larger sense if Hunter Biden could be made to look terrible through testimony. And more to the point, just further accomplishing the original goal of the whole damn thing, which was to recognize that Biden is his biggest threat. He's not nearly so worried about Sanders or Warren.
Well, this is the irony of all this.
This is all about trying to tar his likely...
The irony of all this is that the impeachable conduct the president engaged in is the very thing that the Senate Republicans are now insisting that the Senate trial actually accomplish.
I don't think it's... I think it's a little apples and oranges. But it's what it is. It's not... What he wanted to achieve through the impeachable conduct is what will be and is being accomplished every time we talk about Burisma. Anyways, what do you think is the most likely end result? Will we hear the words, or do we, or is the impeachment going to conclude without the words, and then we all read the words 5 weeks later or 2 weeks later?
I'm so confused at this point about what's going to happen because, like, people are making decisions based on such apparent principles that I don't understand and can't relate to.
Yeah, so you can't prognosticate it?
I don't know what to say.
There you go. We have to have a moment on the show of that sound every time. Well, I'm with you there. Double. Yep. Parallel.
Yep.
All right, should we abandon Bolton and turn towards our other topics?
Yeah, let's abandon Bolton. Everybody else has.
I don't know. Suddenly, you know, he could be the most popular. There is a version of this in which he comes in, lays into it, and there is a timeline in which that starts to perhaps unwind things.
No.
Yes, there's a timeline. All right. We've talked at length on this show about the Inspector General's report into the Carter Page investigations and the what was it, 17 some vastly surprising and remarkable FBI investigative errors that infected the applications to the FISA court for Title I FISA surveillance orders on Carter Page. And we know that there's this ongoing larger review across a selection of cases to see whether that was Carter Page specific, which in some ways is terrible because that adds to sort of this was a political use of FISA or politically inflected use of FISA, but is good in that that would mean it wasn't a general problem with all of FISA. Or was it, in fact, a general problem, which is good in that it wouldn't seem like it was politics, but bad in that it would show that the whole system is screwy. This is taking place against the background of the need to renew or not renew four sort of rifle shot provisions that are FISA related that originally were due on National Cupcake Day. Now the deadline is the Ides of March. And the more there is a reason for Republicans to be concerned about FISA, the more the prospects for a bipartisan alliance that could be a coalition to get a bill through to a perhaps friendly White House on this issue to really pare back FISA in ways that no one thought possible or remotely likely 2 years ago. There are some bills floating around that would do all sorts of things to tweak the FISA system writ large, not just address the four things that are sunsetting. It's too soon to invest time in really talking that through on the show because we need some reason to believe that that actually might get through the Senate. But we're going to watch this space very carefully. And so the latest factual development in the meantime that tweaks all this is that the Justice Department, National Security Division, filed with the FISA court a remarkable sort of mea culpa, basically saying, yeah, those four problematic Carter Page applications, at least two of them were not justified, should not have been put forward. Now, that's a little bit the National Security Division saying, like, yeah, now that we know what FBI did that we did not know at the time, we agree. This is terrible. But it's just kind of Steve, I think it's just a remarkable moment. I don't recall that we've ever had anything quite like that. Are you aware of anything similar?
No, I can't recall that kind of sort of medical. I mean, there's not really an apology, right? But it's
you no, know, but it's saying like, yeah, we agree. These were wrong.
Yeah. Now I think we should stress it was the last two reauthorizations, right? It's important to stress that the government did not disavow the original application, right, or the first reauthorization.
So is this maybe at least in part about the later in the process episode where that one lawyer completely and objectively, crazily and wrongfully,
perhaps criminally
remains to be seen, substantively altered the meaning of a communication in a way that caused NSD to make a wrong representation about whether Carter Page, what kind of prior contacts with CIA he'd had.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth stressing that contra the, you know, right-wing media frenzy, this is not DOJ saying the whole thing was a sham, right? This is DOJ saying that things went off the rails in the middle of the process.
Yeah, which brings me back to something I thought was just really remarkable about the whole episode and the whole story. You know, FBI did clearly did various things wildly wrongly, and all so unnecessarily, because the bar for showing that there was probable cause to be concerned that maybe he was in, maybe he was an unwitting, but nonetheless acting unwittingly, but as an agent of the Russians, there was grist for the mill there without doing any of the dumb stuff.
But all this is to say that I do think the conversation still ought to be, right, whether we need any structural reforms to the process. And some of that's obviously on the DOJ side, and obviously that's part of what David Chris's job is going to be in the next couple months. But I still think it would behoove Congress, if they could find a way to make this not partisan, to have some hearings on FISA reform, right? And to actually revisit some of the proposals. You know, we're not going to agree on what the right answers are, but at least let's have it out.
Well, ironically, it's only because it allegedly became partisan against Trump that real coalition possibilities emerged, where you might get more than just sort of the edge libertarians on the Republican side working with the liberals on the Democratic side. You pull in a larger swath as Trump world has seeped like an oil stain through the Republican Party in Congress, pulling more and more in. It has brought with it that sort of perspective of skepticism about the FBI in particular. Well, so the possibility that March will get super interesting, I think most likely that we actually just get another extension, because if there's really going to be substantial change, I don't think they'll do it very quickly, especially if the impeachment begins to drag out due to the subpoena Bolton issue.
Ugh, it's 2020 sucks.
Well, you know, it's worth noting this. Like, we've all been assuming that the impeachment basically is going to be a January event. And it's like the Super Bowl. It's like, all right, so the NFL season wraps up, the impeachment season wraps up, and then we're off to the NBA or whatever we do in the summer, the election.
The NDAA.
This thing may stretch on for a while. All right, quick lightning round. Gitmo. There's some hearings going on.
There's so much going on in the 9/11 case, and as usual, I'm going to do such a poor job of doing it justice. I would really encourage folks to go check out everything Carol Rosenberg has been filing from Guantanamo over the last 10 days, because Carol, as usual, has been on top of it, right down to live tweeting the earthquake they had. I think it was yesterday they had a little bit of an earthquake. Yeah. So, you know, there's some pretty shocking stuff coming. So, Mitchell and Jessen, these are the two contract psychologists who the CIA hired at the very beginning of what we now call the RDI program, the Rendition Detention Interrogation Program, to help basically figure out how to make the program, In the most neutral terms, most effective.
They wanted to make it as coercive as they could, and they wanted to reverse engineer. Jessen and Mitchell were, I guess they were experts on how the SERI training, search, evasion, rescue, blah, blah, blah. The military training where you assume someone willing to act illegally and unethically will abuse and torture American service members, and so you train them as much as you can to withstand or at least be prepared for what this might entail. And so these guys, the idea was, well, flip that around, like, hey, let's use that and see if we can extract information from our most valuable detainees. And so this is where you get waterboarding, walling, and some other stuff. But this always needs to be said, used in combination, right? None of this stuff is like pick one and only use that and use it once. Used in combination with sleep deprivation and environmental manipulation, extended over time. And so the net of them, this is definitely a the combination is perhaps the real quality to it that's most abusive and coercive of all. So they developed that, and they were supposed to implement it. They made a ton of money doing this, by the way.
I mean, a ton of money, although they then had to pay some of it to the victims. So they're the only people, right, who have been held civilly liable for any of the abuses of Guantanamo or other detainees by the U.S. or U.S. affiliated forces since 9/11, right? There was an out-of-court settlement in the civil lawsuit in Washington State, federal district court in Washington State.
Did they try to claim any kind of governmental immunity?
They did, and it was after those. It was after their sort of, you know, threshold defenses were rejected, right? And there was, I think, some modicum of discovery that they settled.
Oh, interesting. But so if they'd gone all the mat, they may have actually gotten some immunity in the end, but they didn't want to risk it.
Or they got a little, but not enough, right? I mean, so anyway, what I find most horrifying about their testimony is what it corroborates, not what we learn, right? That, you know, it really does. I mean, for those who still think that there is a debate out there between the executive summary of the SSCI torture report and the CIA's response to it, right? I mean, now you have Mitchell and Jessen testifying under oath in lots of ways that actually really go a long way toward supporting the Senate Intelligence Committee's view of things.
Anything off the cuff, do you remember anything particular was contested that they said, no, that's right, it actually went down this way?
That senior CIA program officials were told early on about problems with efficacy, right, that this wasn't effective, that in Abu Zubaydah's case in particular, there were specific decisions made to keep doing it even though it was producing no value.
Interesting.
Right? I mean, like, there was a lot. I mean,
so they really, they kind of, they created this thing, and then they get in here now and testify and say, like, yeah, it was real problematic. We were supervising. It wasn't working. I did hear that they testified that it wasn't, and this is something that's been said before. It wasn't novel, but they confirmed, right, we observed it not being implemented within the boundaries we thought were critical boundaries of how it's used.
But also there was testimony that at least one detainee was subjected to these methods for no other purpose than to demonstrate them.
Okay, so that I thought was the biggest takeaway. To me, that was new and novel. I hadn't ever heard that claim before. And to be clear, they said that it was an application not for the purpose of actually gathering information, but simply to do like a, hey, you want to see how this works? Hey, strap that dude down. That sort of thing. Not saying that's how it was actually said, but is that what the gist of it was?
Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts. This is all in a procedural context in which what is at stake? This is in the 9/11 trial. What is this testimony being offered as relevant for?
So it's, I think a part of it's being offered as relevant to, I mean, there's still a whole bunch of pending motions about like dismissal for outrageous government conduct, about constraining the scope of discovery, about what the defendant should be allowed to present to the members, about whether the death penalty should be on the table, about whether
does
the FBI
suppress
clean team
subsequent
statements.
Clean team statements.
Yes,
I mean, this is about creating the foundations for a torture premise to taint the subsequent clean team statements. And they were elicited by FBI agents coming in later on and just having ordinary otherwise non-coercive conversations with them, which raises the question, how necessary to the government's case are those subsequent statements? Obviously, they're helpful, but is the prospect for actually proving beyond a reasonable doubt KSM and Ramzi bin al-Shib's role and the others' role, is it much dependent on those
words. I don't have a good feel of that, right? I mean, and you know, I'm sure the answer is that the government thinks so, or else it wouldn't be going to the mat over all these issues. But maybe for one or two of the defense, but not all of them, right? But there's, I think also the continuing specter looming over this case that maybe also part of it from the government's perspective is necessary to seek the death penalty, right? Not to prove guilt on the substantive charges beyond a reasonable doubt, but to prove the kind of aggravating circumstances
that might preclude an execution at the end.
And so,
well, because my understanding of KSM is that he didn't deny he did this. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't have the impression that that's going to be part of the defense case in chief. Is like, hey, I was innocent bystander. I don't think that's the case. In which case, the end game really is about death penalty versus non-death penalty, I suppose, or just delay.
Yep.
Now, I rush to add that I'm talking about his end game. I'm sure for many of the people invested in this topic, the end game is all about sort of, you know, getting into the daylight, what actually transpired here, and framing it so that people can see what was wrong with the interrogation techniques, et cetera. I get that. I'm saying KSM's, if he is perfectly happy to admit, I was in Al-Qaeda, I orchestrated this plot, yada, 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 then what exactly is the client's perspective on all this? And I have to assume it's simply just to avoid the death penalty in the end?
I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah. But all this is to say, you know, this Judge Cohen's got a lot of work to do, and you know that trial
supposed to be trial in less than a year. Right?
Good luck, everybody.
Yeah, I do recall somebody on this show, maybe us,
taking the over
on that. Yeah. Okay, real quick, Gallagher.
Oh, that guy.
Okay, so what happened here?
So Eddie Gallagher is one of these soldiers who the president pardoned, right, notwithstanding the substantial evidence against him that he had committed war crimes.
Now, to be fair, because I can just hear people shouting about this, if I recall correctly, he was charged with a variety of offenses, and including murder offenses, and was not convicted on the murder charge.
That's right.
The murder of civilians charge. So I do think we have to be careful in how we how we talk about the war crime element or the war
crime characterization. Fair enough, but we should say, that like a number of his fellow service members testified against him.
Right, for sure. Right?
And that's what, and so now he wants revenge. So he posted a video on Facebook yesterday where, among other things, he names the people who he thinks wronged him.
Right. People testified against him,
where they're stationed, their addresses, and, you know, yeah. basically implies threat, implies like, you know, he doesn't actually say, I'm coming for you, but right. he does, you know, what's the point of putting
so
that out there?
If you get charged with the crime yeah. and all the faculty, we all testify against you, but you get acquitted on
all
most
of, you?
Of the charges. Well, it's most of us. And, of course, Steve, I'm your lawyer. I'd be representing you.
I was going to say.
Which is why you would be convicted probably on at least one charge.
Fair enough.
But then you get pardoned. You would have every right as an ordinary civilian who's not a service member. You'd have every right to put up your blog post about, like, all these people testified against me and my former colleagues.
Yes, because I am not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Here's publicly information. Exactly. But, oh, you cut to the chase.
But I would not have the right to post information that might substantially... I mean, the problem is I could be liable, at least civilly, if not criminally, right, if I actually post information that was not generally available.
Well, say I testified against you, yeah. and you know, my home phone number, which I don't know, you know, I think is...
No, what if I posted your schedule? Right, I okay. say, like, I have access to Bobby's calendar.
Well, let's make it exactly what he did, right? Yeah. So, you know, he works at the University of Texas School of Law, and his home address is XYZ Boulevard. And somebody with a little sleuthing can find that, but it's not meant to be public, let's say. It's not something I circulate. I want it to be private. And it endangers me.
Yeah.
I don't see how I can sue you for that, and I don't see anyone can prosecute for that. And what I'm getting at is, I think what happened here...
So there's the true threat
doctrine.
It's
strictly limited... Well, okay, let's come back to that.
Yeah.
My proposition is the only way there's any legal problem with what he did, I think morally it's a dirtbag move,
well,
obviously.
True.
But the only legal problem is that he is perhaps still subject to the...
Not perhaps.
Is subject to court-martial jurisdiction, and there are charges...
A whole bunch.
...that wouldn't apply to
true.
Any of us in
Good.
Civilian life.
All right, so let's go there. So let's assume there's no possibility of civilian charges, although I think that would turn on the true threats doctrine and exactly how we interpret, right? But let's assume no... Yep. Okay. This is not a close question. He is still subject to the UCMJ.
Because he's in the Fleet Reserve.
He retired, but as I spent, a year of my life running down into a rabbit hole, retired doesn't mean retired, right? That's to say, retired in the military context means changing status to an inactive status where you are still receiving, among other things. So in the Fleet Reserve, it's called retainer pay, but it's basically mm-hmm. retired pay. It's a pension.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the reasons why it was important to him to be pardoned was so that he would be able to have this, you know, retired status as opposed to dishonorably discharged
status. Dumb question. Does he have to be recalled to service to be court-martialed, or is his status in the Fleet Reserve, as you described it, already leaving him subject to court-martial
jurisdiction? So he has to be recalled to be court-martialed, but he doesn't have to be recalled before the offense is committed, right? So while
sure,
he's sitting
right,
on the Fleet
right.
Reserve, right? And the recall...
So basically all retirees... are at risk of, if they commit any crimes...
Under the UCMJ.
Under the UCMJ, not just civilian crimes.
So, or civilian crimes that have been incorporated into the
right.
UCMJ through the general
right.
article.
But for us, since the premise, which I know you don't necessarily agree with, but the premise is
right.
there are no civilian charges.
Yes.
So the interesting question is, if there's something extra expansive,
yes.
as there is, about UCMJ crimes, then you can commit those before being recalled to service?
Yes.
Okay, so then the questions are, one...
I mean, I should say, he's never going to be caught. I mean, they're not going to do it.
No. That's a totally separate question.
Although it would be hilarious if the Navy is like, you know, we're referring charges against
you. Well, I got to say, I'm too quick to say, like, of course they're not going to. I don't know. I think right now, Fort Bragg, in other locations
yeah.
more coastal,
yeah.
I think in the special operations community, this sort of outing and attempt to expose to danger through personal information.
Yeah.
Of all these other service members, I actually think I can imagine that there's a substantial groundswell of desire to see something done about that. Like yeah. that's crossing a line.
True.
I think I'd be interested to hear from listeners whether they agree. Now, what would the offense actually be? What is there in the UCMJ that is sort of this broad sweeping? That's wrong. It's
right.
not a civilian crime, but there's, you know, is it some sort of just, is it conduct unbecoming? What is it?
So there are general articles.
So
there are a bunch of different things. I don't think, so the general article is messy because most of that wouldn't work here. But if any of the people he's referring to, right, are of higher rank, right, there's disrespect towards superior commissioned officers. So if they're, mm-hmm. if any of the people he mentioned are commissioned officers and are superior to him, right, that's pretty disrespectful what he did. That's Article 89.
Okay, maybe.
There's insubordinate conduct toward warrant officers, non-commissioned officers, or petty officers, right?
Is it possible that there is an insubordination element to what he did? What would he be? Is there an order that we could point to?
I suspect that there are. I mean, I suspect that there are things that could be pointed to in that context. Yeah. Trying to think what else. Someone else posted a couple of these the other day. There's like endangerment offenses.
Okay, right? Now endangerment, interesting.
Right, provoking speeches or gestures.
But is endangerment limited in sort of a Brandenburg style way, where endangerment requires this sort of proximity in time and likelihood, et cetera? Because from a free speech perspective, what he did is like classically an illustration of how Brandenburg protects some pretty dangerous speech, but there's not the imminent threat of harm.
But as we've talked about before, the First Amendment doesn't apply the same to the military. I mean, there's Article 88, right? You can't, it is a court-martialable offense to use contemptuous words toward the president.
Which is clearly protected. Right, no, I agree. So that's actually a further step. So if the steps are, yes, he's within jurisdiction, yes, they decide to pull the trigger, yes, we can come up some charges that might work, he might then respond with a First Amendment defense that would work, for an ordinary civilian prosecution where there'd be one somehow, but might not work for him as a service member. In fact, probably wouldn't work.
Anyway, I should say, because not everyone may remember this from prior episodes, right? But I should say, I spent the better part of a year trying to get the Supreme Court to take up whether Article 2A6 is unconstitutional insofar as it confers military jurisdiction over retired service members, including members of the Fleet Reserve. And that issue is still going in the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, which on Friday, in a case called Bagani, split 4-3 as to whether a retired service member, whether the jurisdiction to court-martial retired service members violates equal protection. Two said no, two said the defendant had waived, and so four voted to affirm his conviction. Mm-hmm. Three said yes.
So one vote away from them not being able to recall Gallagher.
At least for the moment. But no, so my point is just that like there is still this, wholly apart from Eddie Gallagher being pretty much a terrible human being, right? There is this broader question about military jurisdiction over retirees that his case actually could be a fascinating test case
You should not insult the man. He could be your future client as you continue to litigate
I wouldn't take that case. I wouldn't take that case.
All right.
I love the issue, and maybe I'd write an amicus brief, but I wouldn't take that case.
All right, there you go. Let me say something that I keep hearing in other shows, and we never say it. If you've reviewed us on iTunes or elsewhere, thank you. I've seen some really nice reviews. I think please go do it if you haven't. Encourage others to do it. And we will kind of keep an eye out for it if we can remember. And if we get something really fun to read or interesting, we'll make a point of reading it on the air next time. All right. That's it for me. What do you got?
You're at Bobby Chesney.
You're at Steve_Vladek.
We are at _NSL Podcast. I say it every week, but wow. Stay safe out there from those pesky, book deals.
Adios.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the University of Texas, to the Strauss Center, and to Bobby and Steve. Please share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook, on Twitter, wherever, and give the Lawfare Podcast a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. The podcast is produced by Jen Patia Howell. And your music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.